Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's time to take a look at the world of birds and birding on the program. Bill Volkert back with us, retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for more than 27 years, I believe, and written a number of books, has led many bird watching tours, and been a regular on this show for a long, long time. Great to have him back. And certainly great to have you listening in. And maybe you want to tell us about the birds you're seeing this time of the year. Maybe you have a question about identifying a bird. You can join the conversation a couple of ways. One way is to call us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email and a photo. If you've got a bird photo you want to identify, we can do that as well. Just go to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about fledgling birds. July is fledgling bird season, is it not?
Well, that's what AI like to think of it. Now, of course, we always have birds that are a little out of sync as early nesters and others that may nest a little later in the year as part of their natural habits. But if we look at most of our songbirds, April and May is a migration season. June is really the nesting season. They're ending the nesting as we get into July. Fledging is the time that the young are leaving the nest. As we get into August, that starts to be what I think of as a flocking season.
Yeah.
And then birds start moving late August, September, and of course, so the geese and swans way into November, even December, as they're moving out. So yeah, this is the time the nesting season is coming to a close, but it's still time long before the actual migration begins. So birds are no longer tied right to that nest site. They're starting to move around a little more. The young are maturing, and they're starting to now move into other areas where there's food available for them, and they're strengthening themselves. And slowly, there'll be preparation for the migration.
So how independent are these young birds?
They will depend on the adults, and this is for songbirds, a couple of weeks that they'll feed them out of the nest. You know, some of the birds, like, say, Eastern Phoebe is known to have more than one brood in a year. Bluebirds certainly do. So you only want to raise those kids for about so long, get them on their own, and start the next family. So oftentimes it can be as little as 2 weeks. So for most songbirds, we have a period of incubation, which is about equal to the same time that they have for rearing in the nest until fledging. So say a robin is about 16, 18 days to incubate the eggs, another 16 to 18 days that the young are in the nest and raised, and then say 2, at the most maybe 3 weeks that the adults are feeding them as they're begging outside of the nest to become independent. And then, hey, kids, you're on your own, and they may start another family.
You know, I when they're in that stage, I mean, it's pretty tough at times to identify them as to what bird we're looking at here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. A very common one, our chipping sparrow, is easily recognized with that rusty cap, nice gray breast. The young ones have fine speckled breasts, and they really lack that distinctive cap and that stripe through the eye. Looks like quite a different bird. So, yeah, that becomes really challenging. So just to identify all the adult birds and recognize males from females where there's different plumage is one thing. The juveniles is a whole other thing.
There aren't any books out there or apps that one could use, are there?
Are there? Well, again, some of them will be more comprehensive than others. And if you're using the Merlin app, there are quite a few pictures of juveniles. Of course, what stage, you know, from just leaving the nest to that immature plumage, like the robin with that speckling on the breast until they eventually will molt and get the characteristic reddish breast. They may have a number of those pictures of young birds. That's becoming more common because you can certainly sight a lot of them at this time of year.
Yeah.
And I would, again, always recommend for people who have any interest in identifying birds, use the Merlin app.
Yeah.
It is a great little pocket field guide, and you also have the sound identification, which is just amazing.
Speaking of sound, the birds are kind of quiet this time of the year.
Yeah, you know, if you wake up right around sunrise, say a month ago or even back in May, we have that morning chorus where everybody's just tuning up and they're singing so many at one time, it's hard to almost filter them out. it's getting a little quieter. A cardinal here, a robin there, an eastern peewee. These are birds that will sing, but they're no longer attracting a mate. So there isn't that urgency to declare a territory, to announce that. And that's what that vocalization is about.
Bruce in Algoma has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I've been dying to get a question out there.
All right.
I have a 100-acre field that's been fallow for 30 years, and the topography is changing. I red twig and all this other stuff is coming. But I used to have a significant population of bobolinks that would show up every year. The last 2 years, significantly less. Is the changing nature of my land influencing that, or is it just something to do with their numbers?
Maybe a little of both. Bobolinks are birds that use the open field. So if you're getting more and more brush, it's becoming less attractive to them. So, yeah, certainly you want a more of an open, sweeping landscape without all that heavy brush cover in there. So that may be certainly one thing that's deterring them. And bobolinks, they're not on the endangered list, but these are birds that are somewhat under pressure because they are so specialized, needing these open fields, formerly the prairies. That's becoming less available as we have changed from pasturing cattle to hay cutting.
Yeah.
This oftentimes takes place during the nesting season. And they're also very long-distance migrants. They winter down in the Argentine Pampas, so there's a lot of challenges to make those long flights.
Is that a bobolink we're listening?
That's the chip calls. The real bobolink song is where they get the name.
Song.
Yeah, very bubbly. Yeah, it's a beautiful song.
Bruce, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us with a question or even a photo to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org.
A quick follow-up for Bruce. If he does want to bring back the bobolinks, they oftentimes are very traditional to where they want to come back to. So clearing out that brush and trying to restore it more to open grassland might be able to bring them back again and make it more attractive.
Yeah, that is a very good idea. Well, gosh, you mentioned migrating earlier. I mean, it's so hard in the first week, you know, of August to talk about, they're starting to migrate already.
Yeah. Well, most birds are not, and it'll be a while before they depart here because right now we still got quite a bit of summer and early fall, which means food is very abundant. And, of course, it gives them that much extra time to not only take advantage of the local resources, but also to strengthen up and prepare for it. But we do already see the very first of the migrants showing up, and those are the sandpipers, the shorebirds. And these are Arctic breeders. And what you have here is a different type of breeding strategy, similar to what, say, ducks, pheasants, turkeys use, which is where the female is rearing the young. And these are what we call precocial young. So when they hatch out, they're fully feathered and they'll start to run away from the nest. Unlike, say, the robin blue jay, where they're born or hatched out in a very immature state. And then the parents have to raise them in the nest. And that's why you need both of the parents, for the most part, to feed and rear those young. So like with ducks, the male is brilliantly colored because that makes him the most attractive for a mate. But the female sure doesn't want him around when you've got young because he just looks like a target.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very camouflaged, as are the young. And the parents then are not raising the young by feeding them directly. They're providing more of a guardianship, taking them to safe areas and where there's food. So you don't have to have both parents around. For ducks, by the way, at this time of year, they're also the males are losing their feathers and they go through what we call a complete molt. In other words, they will slowly over time, just like the Canada geese that you'll see out on the parklands and uplands, they'll start shedding all of their feathers in July, and they become flightless for a period. And so for a mallard, if you've got a bright green head and you can't fly, well, that gets dangerous. So he actually mimics the female, sheds the body feathers too, becomes what we call eclipse plumage, becomes more camouflage. And then regrows those feathers. So because these are fast-flying birds, they want a full complement of flight feathers. They can't afford to lose one at a time. For Canada geese, the same way, the adults start to shed them as the young are out of the nest. And of course, for several weeks, they won't be able to fly anyhow. So it's a good time for the parents to lose their feathers. And that's why they'd be feeding then very close to water, because you can always run to water, which is safe.
Yeah. Gray and Appleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Yeah, I just had a quick question about books to read about birds in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than just the identification books that just show a photo and, you know, differentiating between female and male, I was wondering if you had any book recommendations that went more into depth about behavior or, you know, personality or anything like that about birds in the Wisconsin area.
Well, years ago, there were these Stokes guides that had a little brief thing about behavior of each bird. You can see if those are still available. There's always new books coming out. If you're traveling around Wisconsin at any of the parks or nature centers, I would go into the gift shop, take a look what's available. They oftentimes carry quite a few of the local ones. Another good source for birding books for libraries is Beautio Books, which is a book dealer out east. They've got a massive online library. You can check there as well. It's a huge topic. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out there. And there also there's the individual life history. So if you're interested in either a particular species or a family of birds, there's specialized books on those topics as well.
So lots out there.
Yeah, and some of the very old classics, because these were well studied a long time ago, and bird behavior doesn't change. So even what was written in the 40s and 60s is still relevant today. And, of course, they're repackaging a lot of these things,
yes,
making it a little more accessible. And a lot of that stuff is also online. Yep.
Thank you very much for calling. Lois in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Lois.
Hi there. I saw a Bolek oriole the other day, and I found out they're very rare. And I know I have orioles all the time, so I know it's not a typical oriole that Baltimore or whatever or orchard. So just FYI, I didn't get a picture, unfortunately.
Okay, well, that's good. That's an interesting sighting. Bolek's oriole is the western counterpart of our Baltimore oriole. So we have Baltimore oriole in the eastern United States, central U.S. We've got the open prairies. Well, it's not a good place for a forest bird. And as you get into the western forested areas, the Bolek's oriole takes its place. We hear them chattering out there. Very nice.
Yeah,
little.
It's nice that Jeff had a little chattering going on while you were talking. That's cool.
And it's not a common bird here because they have to cross the prairies and or those central states. We'll have a few sightings in, say, Minnesota, Wisconsin over the years.
Lois, thanks again for calling.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator, talking birds with him. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email your photo or your question to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at the world of birds and birding with Bill Volkert. Join in. If you got an email, you could email a photo or a question to talk@WPR.org. And we did get an email from Mary, photo of what she found while doing checks and cleanouts of birdhouses, and she found 3 expired birds there, I think, Bill.
Yeah, those look to be the immature or the young fledglings of the tree swallow, or actually more nestlings. They haven't even fledged. And there was a little bit of a cautionary note this year for people with martin houses, and it probably applies as well for the tree swallows. All the heavy rain that we've had made it difficult for the adults to be able to feed. They're what we call aerial insectivores. In other words, they got to fly around and catch the insects out of the air. Well, when it's raining out, there's not much flying, and it's very difficult to capture that kind of food. And there actually was some starvation of young this year because of the exceptional amount of rain. It just made it tough to go out and find enough food during those weather events.
Sad. But it's good to have the explanation. I hadn't thought of it, but that rain, you're right. We had so much rain.
Yeah, it's just off the charts. And on the other hand, it was also a pretty good year for duck nesting. So DNR always and Fish and Wildlife Service do the continent-wide duck surveys. And what they're doing is they're flying the same route, looking at the number of spring ponds, the flooded wetlands out there. So take a look at available habitat, and then they'll be also looking for the adult pairs on the ponds, how many are out there. So we certainly had a lot of water, which means a lot of the wetlands had water. And for a water bird, that's always spells good news for them. So it seems like they had a good nesting season. One thing to keep in mind is when we do these surveys, we always refer to wildlife counts as surveys. When we count people, that's a census. Mm-hmm. And the difference is a census is we're trying to get an exact
everybody.
Count. Everybody. Wildlife, you can't count them all. You just can't walk in the woods and find them all. So what we're trying to do is our best way of how can we find a good representative number, and then we look at relative change. Are they up a bit or down a bit from the average over the years? We still don't know the exact number. We can try to mathematically extrapolate. It becomes a guess of how many are in the population, but we can take a look at the percentage of change. Are they doing better this year or a little worse than they have done over the years? And that's really how those surveys are then analyzed.
Christy in Chippewa County, your turn. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
An observation and two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday afternoon, it was incredibly hot and humid, as you remember, and I was sitting by my wall of glass that overlooks purple coneflowers, a couple of water features, and cedars, and I noticed a very small bird flit into the coneflower that were within 3 feet just on the other side of the glass, and the bird was below me. It was clearly smaller than a chickadee, and it perched where I could see a view from above, and it had a bright yellow crown. It had a black mask. It had white mustache and eyebrow. Its back was gray, dark gray, had mm-hmm. a small dark.
Excellent description.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. I didn't dare flinch.
And you're talking about the black mask across the face? That's a common yellow throat, which is one of our warblers. They're mostly found in wetland edges and tall standing wetland scrub and grasses. And they will also come into the uplands a little bit. So that's blue-wing warbler.
Yeah.
This is common yellowthroat, which is the witchetty. So your tall coneflowers and prairie plants out there provide a kind of an attractive little feeding area for it. Good for you.
Yeah. Good for you, Christy.
Another question?
A closer look, I was convinced it was a golden wing warbler, but I'll go back to my field guides and cross-reference that. Question is that, mm-hmm. I mean, consistently each morning, May, June, July, mid, early July, indigos and bluebirds,
mm-hmm.
and they seem to have disappeared. I don't know if they're on their nest and really quiet, or they just left my wooded lot.
Could be either one. Indigo bunting is an interesting one because when they arrive in springtime, they will hit feeders for the first week or two. And I hear this all the time. Where do they all go? There it is, that paired notes.
Mm-hmm.
Too high, down, up, down, up, down. Always two quick notes. Well, what you have is a very brilliant, deep indigo blue bird, which, of course, is the reflected light. If he's sitting in a tree or on a power line above you, the light is hitting its back. He looks black. So you don't see those colors. So you have to have the right angle to really see the bird, for one. And they like to nest in the dense tree cover. So you'll see them in springtime as the leaves are just emerging and the birds are arriving. And then it seems as if they all disappear. But if you listen for them, you'll find they're actually fairly widespread. Mm. And so that's how we really do our surveys for them. It's almost all by sound.
Thank you, Christy.
So do learn that song, yes.
Yeah. Linda emailed a photo while kayaking the Plover River in Stevens Point yesterday.
Yes.
Is this an osprey?
Yes, it is. Also called fishhawk is a generic name for it. Yeah, that's osprey. It is a bird that has been on our state threatened list. It has been recovering fairly well over the last 40 years in Wisconsin. And it is a specialist. It does feed exclusively on fish.
Yeah. She also mentioned that they used the Merlin app and recorded 8 different birds in 10 minutes.
Oh, there you go.
Had to put the phone away to pay attention to her kayaking.
Yeah.
Samantha in Whitehall, it's your turn. Hi, Samantha.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, my grandma passed away in 2014, but she had a good knowledge of like what bird sounds, you know, what this bird, that bird. I know what a chickadee sounds like, but other than that, I'm not sure. Now she's gone. Now this day and age, you know, what's a good place to look and try to study some of the birds, especially the ones in like Minnesota, Wisconsin, so that if you're out and about, you mm-hmm. can tell what this or this or this or this. And I'll take my answer off air. I just want to know what to look for. So.
Well, it's a very good question, and we were just talking about the Merlin app, and there's basically two approaches you can use to learn bird songs. You can do it the way I did, which is the hard way. Listen to everything you hear, walk out there, look at it, identify which bird is making what sound, and try to memorize that. And that can take you literally decades, and what took me 25 years or more to learn, you can now download the Merlin app. It's from Cornell University. Put it on your cell phone. You just hold that up, put on song ID or sound ID. Hit that, it's recording the sounds, and it will identify, there'll be a little picture icon of every bird that it's hearing. And then you can go to that bird and actually listen to the recorded songs, songs and calls. And my brother's been using that. He's always been impressed with my ability to be able to identify songs. He just shakes his head about it. And now he's sitting there with his phone. He goes, I got this and that. And it made it very easy for him. He didn't have to go through it the hard way I did. So, yeah, I've run into a number of people that have really kind of explored and been open to the world of bird sounds with the Merlin app. Strongly recommended. It's great.
Rita in Wisconsin Rapids emailed to say they noticed catbirds in their yard for the first time, wondering if they're prevalent in the Wisconsin Rapids area.
Yes, and we have a vocalization here for a catbird.
We do.
It's one of the mimics, and he's a chatty bird. On and on. He'll just go on. This is a long song, yeah. And occasionally the meow that you hear in there, which is where he gets his name. Catbird loves the nest in thick shrubs, just like cardinals. So, yeah, a lot of forest edges and heavy shrubbery. These are common nesting places. And now they'll migrate down into, say, Mexico, northern Central America. They're pretty widespread across Wisconsin, but since they're living in these dense shrubs, they can make a lot of noise and really hide, like we talked about with indigo bunting earlier. Hard to see when all the vegetation's out, easy to hear. And if you... want to make it easy, let's, you know, on yourself, go back to the Merlin app. You'll be able to hear those birds. They're actually fairly widespread across Wisconsin.
Andrew in Madison, your turn. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding house sparrows. I started really disliking them when I saw them kicking out my house wrens out of their nest, and now my house wrens seem to be less prevalent, and the sparrows are all over. I was wondering if there any way to get rid of them, or what do you have to say about house sparrows?
Well, house sparrows, of course, are not native to North America. It is a European, Eurasian species. The name house sparrow is because they oftentimes are nesting around human dwellings, so they're in the cities. Yes, they will make their nests in cavities or overhangs of houses and so forth. And, yeah, they can be a competitor for house wrens and also for our bluebirds. The best thing there is the monitoring of your boxes and try to discourage the house wren from setting up shop. And if you put up more than one box, you oftentimes will have a chance for the house wren to try to nest in one and the house sparrow to try to occupy another, and then you can manage it. If you're looking for hints for managing cavity nesting songbirds, I would go to the Bluebird Restoration Association website. It's certainly focused on bluebirds, but there's some really good hints if you have tree swallows, as we saw the picture earlier, house wrens and other cavity nesters. And you put up a box, you may have any one of those using it as well, depending on your particular neighborhood. So the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, go to their website. There's a lot of good hints of house designs, how to monitor them, and how to manage them, and how sparrows are addressed there.
Great site. Andrew, thank you. Kurt in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about... robin nests. I had a robin that nested in the peak of my garage. There's a little attic space up there. And I watched the nest being built, and I'm like, oh, that's nice. And eventually there were birds in there and eggs in there, and then I saw her feeding or him feeding little birds. Well, I was up in that garage, and there was a moth trapped up there, and I thought, I'll force it out this window. So I moved that screen, and those robins, it must have been both of them, were just going nuts, the adults. And I stuck the screen back in. The moth did go out. I should have just dealt with the moth, but I thought I would try to give it a chance to get out. And I don't know. It was probably within a week, my wife goes, oh, those birds are gone. It looks like that nest is done. And so in the back of my mind, I'm wondering, did I cause them to abandon that nest with that little activity? The birds looked, you know, the babies looked like they were a good size, mm-hmm. but I couldn't get a good look at them. They didn't look chubby and fluffy like some chicks look. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the question, is that what happened? Or because I don't see how they could move the nest either when the birds are so big they wouldn't have been. It's
not no, like they're not going to do that. Usually that short-term disturbance is not going to give birds a cause to completely abandon a nest. So even for bird banding, we've done that with bluebirds in the nest box. So we can open it up, get in there, band the young, or, as I mentioned earlier, the Bluebird Restoration Association will recommend monitoring of the nest. You can open it up, take a look in there, count the number of eggs, take a look at the young, a quick peek in there. Yeah, the parents may, as you had them, you know, really freak out and be bombarding you and become very defensive and aggressive while you're there. They don't want you around, but they'll be really relieved as soon as you leave. So that short term should not have really given them cause to abandon. I would imagine they were probably close enough. And you said within a week they were gone, probably grew up that quick and were out of the nest. Now, another myth that comes up is if you touch a bird nest or bird egg, the parents can smell that and abandon it. For the most part, birds don't have a good sense of smell. Vultures and some of the seabirds do, but otherwise songbirds, it is not a well-developed sense for them. The myth is probably holds a little bit of true because I think that kids, it's the curiosity. Oh, I found a nest. I want to show my friends. I want to see how they're doing. That repeated intrusion and proximity to the nest, then the parents may get the feeling, this is not the safe hidden place that I thought it was. We'd be better off to abandon it and start somewhere else. And usually that's early in the nesting when you have just eggs. They're looking for a secure place. They may abandon them. Once they've invested so much time to rear those young, they're getting grown, they put all that energy into it, and they're all just about ready to leave. It takes a little bit more disturbance for them to actually abandon. So I would imagine they just fledged on their own.
Singing about last year on my morning trot around the neighborhood in the early morning, I'm going along and I go by this one bush and suddenly I get whacked in the back of my head by a bird.
So, he's probably doing that for every pedestrian in that neighborhood.
I turned around to try and look and see it. I saw the bird, but it was quickly back into the bush, and I didn't see what it was even. It hit me 2 days in a row.
That reminds me of an interesting story. There was a fella in the biology department at one of the smaller campuses around Wisconsin who was studying red-winged blackbirds. There were some ponds on campus, and he was banding the birds in the ponds, and interestingly, of all the students that were walking around, the red-winged blackbirds learned to recognize him as a threat and would dive bomb him, and students would be walking by and they would ignore him. So they actually picked him out of the crowd that this guy is a danger and nobody else is. So interesting behavior.
Kurt, thanks again. Jolie and Mosinee will go to you. Hi, Jolie.
Hello. Just wanted to mention, in Mosinee here, we've been having those white pelicans flying around. And I think they're going into the backwaters of the river, plus going over in the backwaters down farther of the river. And they fly low, and there's been a dozen or so. And just this morning, there were six of them flying low. Is that something that they're coming back, or what is with them?
Yeah.
Well, we've talked about pelicans in the past. We've had periodic sightings over the many years throughout the there's the grunting of them on the nest site. not the best vocalization there. He sings like I do. But pelicans, they started to show up in Wisconsin in increasing numbers in the 1990s, beginning a nest in Green Bay first, then at Horicon Marsh. And over the years, we've had more and more nesting sites established in some of the larger water areas and along the Mississippi River. These are birds that do not begin to nest until they're probably about 4, 5, even 6 years old. So we do see the non-breeders, the immature birds, moving around in these flocks. They tend to feed in a flock and essentially do it by herding. So they'll look for small minnow swarms and schools, and then the pelicans will spread out, start to herd them all together, and that's where they use that bucket mouth to just scoop.
Yeah.
So unlike a heron who's looking for an individual fish and will dart out and grab that prey item, these guys are just concentrating the food and just start scooping, and you'll get something in your mouth. So, yeah, interesting. And it is a somewhat newer nesting species in Wisconsin over the last 25 years or so.
Thanks again, Jolie. Brad in Osceola, we'll go to you now. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about bird feeding about mm-hmm. this time of the year. We bird feed pretty much year-round, but I'm kind of wondering if it is best to back off a little bit when the young birds are, you know, learning to eat and stuff like that. Otherwise, they get acclimated to just the feeder and not do the wild feeding.
Probably not. There's also been this story and concern that, well, if we feed hummingbirds late into the fall, that they'll become so dependent on food they won't leave. They'll leave regardless of the food. And in fact, for some that remain a little late in the season, it may be the lifeline before they actually get the signal to head out. For the most part, feeding is for our enjoyment. I always think of it as fast food. It's there. It's convenient. Yeah, we may all stop quickly to grab something. It's not the healthiest thing, and you wouldn't want to live on it. But it is a way to bring the birds in. And studies have indicated that probably 75 to 80% of a bird's diet, even in wintertime, is from the wild. This is just something that's convenient and easy for them. They don't need it. And it's also probably not doing any serious harm. We've never been able to bear that out, that we shouldn't be. The biggest concern I would have is during this hot, humid weather, make sure that every so often, probably every couple of weeks, when your feeders are completely empty, you might want to disinfect. Get some warm water bleach, rinse them out, give it a good clean rinse, let them dry completely and start over, because we don't want spoilage of food or accumulation of bird droppings where we might have an individual carrying a disease to an area where we're concentrating birds. That's probably the biggest danger that we have with bird feeding.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phyllis in the town of Dunn, we'll go to you now. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. So I was riding my bike on one of Dane County's many wonderful bike trails, and I went by quickly, but I saw something that was really strange, and it was a bird. I think it was a robin. And it was perfectly still on a bush, and its mouth was open. And I thought, it's dead. I think a butcher bird put it there. So I just looked it up, and it says we are in the area. I had no idea that shrikes or butcher birds were in this area. And I wonder if you think that's what I saw.
Well, the shrike, or the folk name butcher bird, it comes from them impaling their prey because they don't have strong feet like hawks or owls to hold it. So they'll actually impale it on a thorn or barbed wire or wedge it in a little shrub to hold it so they can then pull it apart, a prey item that's too big to swallow whole. There are two species of shrikes in North America, the northern shrike, which is nesting in Canada and is a winter visitor to Wisconsin, so wouldn't be here now, and loggerhead shrike, that is a southern species. It is on the endangered list for Wisconsin, very rare. So we're, first of all, at the far northern edge of its range to begin with, and we've seen some decline over the years. And there's that little call, just a real simple little high whistle or peep out of the bird. I would probably rule out shrike as fairly likely because we just don't have a lot of them here, especially this time of the year. Doesn't mean it's impossible. Very little in the natural world is. But you say the bird was dead. Sometimes what you will find is in this hot weather, birds will sit, they'll spread their feathers out to do some sunning, to try to get a little bit of air and sunlight on below the feathers. kind of like getting a good massage. And the other thing is sometimes they'll just sit there and they'll just pant. They'll just sit with their mouth wide open and just to try to relieve themselves from the heat and the sun.
Yeah, so that may be what you saw as well, Phyllis. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us a question or photo to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Bill Volker for WPR News. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we learn how to avoid passport scams, and then we'll talk about how military veterans can access the benefits and resources they need. That's tomorrow on the show. Right now, we're looking at birds and birding with our guest, Bill Volkert. If you have a question or an experience to share, give us a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Bill, the spring waterfowl survey came out from the DNR. They released some data from the annual spring survey of breeding waterfowl. How does the DNR use this information?
Well, because we have a hunted species, they want to be able to find out how many birds are being produced for the year that will provide us then the allowable hunt. So essentially, if you're hunting any species, a couple of things you need to know is how many are out there, how many young are they raising, what is your population goal? Do you want to maintain the number of individuals, whether it's deer or ducks or geese that you have? Do you want to allow it to increase or do you want to decrease it? So you need to know how many are there. You want to set your goal as to where what you want to achieve. And then you want to take a look at the number of young they produce and what is surviving, what is added to the population. For birds like our ducks and geese, and for most wildlife, hunting is considered to be what we call compensatory mortality. In other words, a fair percentage of those individuals that are born this year are going to die of natural causes anyhow. And whether we shoot one first or it dies from something else later on, hunting is not a major impact. There are a few, especially long-lived species that have very few young, take a long time to mature, that we refer to as additive mortality. So there isn't a real big loss of it. And hunting is, we have to be much more conservative because it is adding to the natural mortality. So then what you want to do is you're looking, first of all, at your breeding pairs and your wetlands. You're flying over. What are the conditions of the wetlands? Are there a lot of them there with a lot of water that is at least potential brood water and habitat? And how many birds are sitting on it to occupy it? Then by midsummer, we do random brood counts. Anytime you see a hen with a bunch of young, how many have survived in there? And you're just getting a sample. It's in a sense, kind of like an exit poll. You don't want to have to talk to everybody. You'll get the count of the votes later, but let's just talk to a sample of people. And from that, we'll get an idea of where it's trending anyhow. And that's what we do is get some averages. From there, we extrapolate what we think has been added to the population, and then we allow the that to be the huntable quota for the year. And so what happens in waterfowl, especially for ducks, the federal government sets a framework, whether it's a conservative, an average, or a long season, 30, 45, or 60 days. The states can tweak that, and Wisconsin does a split season. So we have an early hunt, then we pause and we wait for a little while for the northern divers. And what we also do is we take part of our quota of blue-winged teal because they leave by the time the season's even opening. We give it to the southern states. They can take a few more of what would be allocated to Wisconsin. And they, in trade, give us some of the diving birds. So with that, we can continue to hunt every year without injuring the population as long as we stay within that margin of only taking what is being added each year. And it's why we refer to it as a harvest. It's sustainable harvest. And that's what modern hunting is. And that's the science behind it. So it sounds very simple in terms of its math, but you have to understand the habits of the birds, how to count them. Some are easier than others. And then how to gather all of that data and then take a look from there at what we're going to allow. The other variable that comes up is, say, with turkey hunting, we can take a look at the population and how many toms we think is allowable for the springtime. And then we survey also hunter success, how many of those hunters actually got a bird. And so if only one in four get it, you can have four times the number of permits because not everybody's going to actually take a bird. So that also adds into another variable into the whole mathematical formula.
Lots going on there. Mark in Sussex, we'll go to you now. Mark, what's on your mind?
I was great show as usual.
Thank you.
I was wondering why mallards will nest out in a field that looks like perfect bobolink habitat. And it's long ways from any water, but I've seen them nesting out in these open fields.
Yeah, good question. You know, some of our ducks will nest more than a half mile from the nearest water, especially out in the Dakotas. There's our typical quacking of the mallard. So they're upland nesters. They need tall grass as a secure area where to lay those eggs. And then they need to take those young when they hatch and take them to the brood water. That's both the safety, they're out away from predators on that water, and that's where the food is, usually the small insects and vegetable material. And so especially out in the Dakotas, which is the waterfowl biologists refer to it as the duck factory. It is the highest concentration of waterfowl production in the world. And where you've got the prairies and these little ponds and wide open sweep of grassland, sometimes your nest might be a bit of a distance from that water where you find secure nesting area. And then that little bit of danger, get those young to that nearest brood water so you can rear them.
Mark, thank you for calling. Don in Gratiot, we'll go to you now. Hi, Don.
Hello. Yeah, I got a question about cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
The other day I saw a male cardinal with a black bill, and that was different from the orange bill that they have. Wondering why.
This is a young one. And when the young ones are first hatched out, they actually have the color of the female, and then slowly they'll go through a molt, and they'll get the adult color, and then that bright red is really more intense in the breeding season, so the bill color will actually intensify too.
There you go.
Yeah, you've got a younger bird.
A younger bird, Don. Thank you for calling. Robert in Middleton, it's your turn now. Hi, Robert.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment that people hopefully will find interesting, and then that leads to a question about Oreos. I've tried very hard to get Oreos over the years, and now I have probably two or three dozen different individuals, mostly Baltimore, a pair or two of orchard Oreos. But twice in 25 years, I've seen this. I've seen a mature, brilliant, very large male bird fly in, land on the branch above my two feeders, and then was followed once by three babies and once by four. And then he flew down, grabbed a bill of grape jelly, went up and gave each one of them in turn a bite of the grape jelly. And sat there, looked at him like, okay, guys, you're on your own. And then he flew off.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that twice.
Oh, great.
And I thought that was really incredibly. And then they sat there, and then the bravest one went down, and eventually they all went down to get their own little nibble of dessert.
Yeah, that's that teaching period.
Yeah. Well, my question is, do birds teach their young? For instance, will those Oreos teach the young how to catch insects? Will seed feeders teach the young how to find seeds?
Good question. There is a little bit of that involved there. It's something that's going to be difficult to observe. As you said, you've only seen it twice in 25 years. So to really be able to catch that and see how much of that is going on, how much is instinct and how much of the parents are actually trying to help them out, I think it's a combination of each, that there's some instinct there, but the parents have to teach them to perfect that a little bit and to learn a little. So swallows, you can't completely teach them how to catch insects out of the air, but they certainly do help them a little bit to take them where that food is. They will capture some and bring it to them and then try to indoctrinate them a little bit and get them independent. But yeah, that's a good question and probably varies a little bit from species to species as well.
Robert, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Kay in Maryland next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I have a question on turkey vultures.
Mm-hmm.
In the springtime, we have huge flocks of them circling town. And now, are they the ones that look like they have fingers on the end of their wings? Or
yes.
Is that a different? Okay, then they are turkey vultures.
Yes.
I wasn't sure. And I got the pathology thing you guys told us about.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can, you know, just set your phone out and it tells you what birds are there.
Yes.
I listen to the turkey vulture, and that's the most horrid thing I've ever heard.
They're usually very silent. They don't really produce a lot of sound, and if they do, it's more often than right near the nest site, just a hiss. Yeah, it's not what we call a bird song, is it? No.
No.
A hoarse screech.
Okay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark in Winnicotty emailed to say about 3 years ago they saw for the first time a yellow-headed blackbird in their neighborhood. Now they see dozens. Are they new to the area, or did Mark just not notice them earlier?
Well, yellow-headed blackbird is a bird of deep water marshes, and they're more common west of here out in the prairies. They are punctuated a bit in specialized marshes as little kind of loose colonies. And sometimes over the years, those colonies move around. So we do have a population at Horicon. Sometimes we'll see a number of them near a trail or the roadside where they are visible. If they move it deep into the interior of the marsh, they may become far less visible to the public. So, yeah, it's a rather unique bird for us.
Kent in Reedstown emailed to say they have three different bird boxes, and between May 28 and June 1st, there were chicks in the boxes, but they were dead by early June. It wonders if gnats were killing the babies.
Well, you do have feather mites and nest mites. These are insects that will live down in that nest material, come up in the evening and feed from the blood from the young, and they can cause mortality. That's why it's important to clean out the boxes so we can keep that down a little bit to reduce and remove those populations. Just like with your garden, you want to get all the old stuff out because that harbors the disease for the next year's crop. So, yeah, you want to keep that clean. Also, like earlier, we talked about the tree swallow. It could have also been that, the starvation of the young.
Yes,
yep,
as well. For the first time tomorrow, the Wisconsin Legislative Council Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes is meeting. What's the significance of this committee?
They're looking into a proposal for holding the first ever crane hunt in Wisconsin. And this is a very emotional issue, and it's certainly something that can be quite controversial among people. The issue comes up because, yes, as crane populations have increased, there's also been an increasing amount of crop damage for the farmers. And in the past, and this is still actually holds, the only way that we have currently under legislation paid for crop damage for animals comes from hunting license fees. So when deer do damage, we use the money from the license sales. So it's not tax money, but that's what compensates the farmer for it because, we've got a lot of deer here and the farmer is incurring that loss because of those deer. And we want to make sure that if he's so-called feeding those deer out there, that this is not a hardship and an economic loss. So the hunters provide them money. And the legislators have said they would not want to pay compensation unless we had a hunting season. So now it's become a bit of a political issue. I would not sell it, though, however, that this is what's going to solve the problem for the farmers. And now let me explain. When I worked at Horicon Marsh, I started there when Dick Hunt was still working as the waterfowl and wetlands research team leader. And he's in the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame because he actually developed a program for hunting to address crop damage at Horicon. By the 1970s, we had 250,000 geese at Horicon. And there was fears about disease epidemics among such a flock, and the flocks would get into the farm fields, and they could just devastate a field. So you can imagine 10,000, 20,000 geese in a field. They can clean a farmer out in 3 days. So we designed a program where we had hunting, which was different periods, yeah, and also only one goose a day. And I used to have hunters coming up and go, "Well, God, you guys, you got to give me 3 permits, but I have to keep coming back. I could have shot them all the first day." Well, the idea is it wasn't how many geese we shot, but you put a hunter in a field, he may shoot only one goose that day, but he's just chased the 10,000 out. The problem for cranes comes down to that they're doing the damage in spring and we want to hunt them in fall. It's not going to alleviate that. And the last thing is that it's a learned behavior. A few individuals are the ones that are causing the damage, and we may not shoot the culprits who's causing the damage. So it's not going to work.
Bill Volker, thank you so much. Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator. Great to have him with us to talk birds and birding. And he will be back, and we will do this all over again with him. Coming up, we're going to take a look at your bicycle and trips that you can take on your bike and how to fix your bike. And our next guest will be coming up right after this look at the news. A little music by Queen there, Bicycle Race, to start the show, the segment of our show where we talk about bikes. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today and spending an hour with Ian A-Strike, who's been with us a few times before. It's great to have him back. Founder and owner of Traveling Bike Repair Shop. It's called Curbside Bicycles, located in Madison and Chicago. He's had a busy spring and summer getting people out on their bikes. He's here to share a few bike tips and tricks and encourage you and me to ride while the weather is still great for biking. And we've still got quite a bit of weather for good biking yet as we move along. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Have you had a trip, been on a bike trip of yours that you might want to comment on one way or another? Maybe your bike's showing some wear, either from overuse or maybe from neglect. Maybe a favorite biking event or place to ride in Wisconsin. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800. 642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Ian, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Larry. It's like you said, still beautiful weather and tons of biking season left.
Absolutely. Your business, and we talked about this last time you were on, but I think it bears repeating. Curbside Bicycles, a traveling bike repair shop, and you operate in the Madison area, but also in Chicago. How do you connect with customers?
Yeah, totally. So this started during COVID in 2020. It was kind of out of a necessity on two ends. One, bike shops were swamped. They were sold out of bikes, so everyone was bringing their bikes out of their garage and bringing them into a shop, and shops would say, oh, sorry, we're a month out. And two, I was unemployed due to COVID, so I had time on my hands and I knew how to tune up bikes. So it actually started me reaching neighbors just in my own neighborhood. My first pop-up was for my neighbors to give me something to do. I totally didn't know I was starting a business. And it went off so well that then, like, someone, oh, I live six blocks away, you want to come into my neighborhood? And that was successful. And then I branched out into other cities. And then, so we're 5 years in now. Neighborhoods are still kind of our bread and butter. I love being in different communities and just helping out. You know, imagine you're walking your dog in the morning in your neighborhood and you see a guy fixing bikes for the day. And you're like, this is great. That happens all the time. And then we also now do during the weeks apartments and condos and businesses and farmers markets and breweries, which are all reached through both my website and also their networks.
He had a nice website, by the way. The website is curbsidebicycles.com.
Curbsidebicycles.com.
Yeah.
Thank you, Larry. Yeah, I built it myself, and I've tweaked it over the year to be user-friendly. We're in Madison. That's where I started, and actually my mechanic from 2021 loved the concept so much that that winter we kind of workshopped how to expand. And so she is the one, Amber, runs the branch in Chicago. This is her third year in business. And that's also going great. So
she loves it. She's working well down there. I'm wondering, how do you, let me put it this way. Is it difficult to establish ongoing relationships with customers when you don't have a brick and mortar shop?
It's really interesting. So it absolutely, we don't show up as well, like on Google Maps. So if someone just looks up bike shop, you'll see the brick and mortars and you go, oh, I want to go to a bike shop. So for us to get the lasting customers, it really requires us to provide like awesome customer service, great bike maintenance, and then also give them, you know, our business card and say, hey, if you're in the Madison and Chicago area, just go on the website at curbsidebicycles.com. There's a map on there with a pin dropped at all of our upcoming locations. and then you can click any of those locations and sign up for a tune-up. So the more people were able to convey, like, we may not have a physical brick-and-mortar shop, but if you bring it to one of the pop-ups, you get same-day service. That really appeals to people. So I think our biggest repeat customers and our loyal customer base are people who, like, don't want to leave their bike at a shop for 3 weeks because yeah. they commute or they, like, they want to ride every day. And that's awesome. It's really cool to be able to help people get the maintenance that honestly they need, like, to keep their bike safe, but also keep them on their bike and not take it away from them for weeks.
Diane in Mercer has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Diane.
Hi. iCor, which is a silent sports club in the area, are putting on an event on Sunday, August 4th here in Mercer at Carroll Park. And it's to promote our effort to make a loop. There's an existing bike trail that goes from Mercer to Manitowish Waters, but we would now like to go from Winman, that's in that area, back to Mercer and make a complete 28-mile loop. And cool. the engineers that are doing the feasibility study will be there answering any questions. We're going to have food, music, door prizes, and a raffle.
So this is at right at Mercer, Diane?
In Mercer at Carroll Park.
At Carroll Park, and what time?
12 to 3 p.m.
12 to 3 p.m. Well, that sounds like a worthwhile project.
Absolutely. I love loops. Like, my hometown just got a lake loop, and it's amazing how much different loops help encourage people to do things. Yeah.
Yeah, Diane, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, number 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. Yeah, I was thinking about this. I wouldn't even know how many times I have looped around Lake Monona in Madison. It's, about 12, 13 miles around. It's just a nice little ride.
Oh, it's great. Totally. You get to see, there's some elevation. You get to see a lot of different neighborhoods. I actually saw you. Do you remember at the Loop the Lake ride?
Yes.
Did your bike work better?
After it did.
Lovely. Good. Yeah, you showed up and I was like, oh, let me take a look at your bike. And I'm happy that I was able to fix some stuff. That's great.
Oh, man. So let's talk about the kinds of things you do with bike. Or maybe first, what kind of bikes do you typically work with and able to fix?
Yeah, we run the gamut. So starting off, it was all, imagine just what people are going to pull out of their garage in your neighborhood. So it's kids' bikes. It's your bike that you've neglected and hung from the rafters for 10 years. Or it's the well-loved commuter bike that you go to work on every single day. So largely mid-range bikes. But then now we're actually connected with a lot of different bike rides, races, and triathlons in the area. So now we work on a lot more higher-end bikes, which is its own challenge, but also like a fun thing to do. And also recumbents, tandems, and e-bikes obviously are a huge opening segment in the market that allow people who maybe weren't able to go a distance before to be able to ride further, or maybe not able to ride at all because their knees were replaced, as an example, to now get back on a bike. So I work on all sorts of e-bikes. I'm sure we'll get that inevitably. There will be e-bike questions, so yeah, we can talk about that later. But I think there's no bike that I won't at least take a look at.
So which components of a consumer's bike are you fixing or replacing most often?
Absolutely. And I'm going to answer this question, and then I'm also going to lead into like one of the most commonly asked questions that I get that I want to just provide the knowledge to everybody. So most often, obviously, if you have a flat tube, that gets replaced. And that's, you know, intermittent, hit or miss, depending on where you're riding. The most often worn part is the chain. So if you bring your bike into any mechanic, generally they'll put a chain checker in your chain, and your chain just wears out through riding. So if it just sits in the garage, nothing will happen. Your chain is fine. as you ride, it does start to stretch, metal wears apart, and then as it stretches, it starts to eat away at your whole drivetrain, so that being the gears. And then down the line, if you don't replace the chain, you will have to replace the whole kit and caboodle and the cassette and the freewheel and everything. So it's you could actually people listening at home, if you say, oh, I don't know if my chain is good or not, you can get a chain checker for like 10 bucks, throw it in the chain, and that'll tell you if it's good or not. So I probably do 300 to 400 chains in a season. Next up would be brake pads, and those you can just do a visual inspection to see if they're worn. It's just rubber that's pushing on a rim or little brake pads on a disc brake. And then from there, there's, you know, sometimes people's cables get rusty and stuff, but generally it's chains, brake pads, and tubes as needed.
Somebody's already wondering, what is a chain checker? What does it look like?
It's a long metal thing that has like, it's just a length, a chunk of metal, almost looks like a ruler with two little prongs. One goes, hooks into one side of the chain, and then the other one, if your chain is not stretched, it'll get stopped by the chain rivet. If it is stretched, it'll drop in between chain rivets.
Oh.
And there's a, you can Google it, you know, just look at the measurements.
Oh, man. Okay.
I did want to say one more thing.
Yes,
so
go ahead.
With the tube replacements,
yes,
a lot of times, the most frequently asked question I get is, oh, I think my tubes are losing air way faster than I think they should. I probably need new tubes. So most likely, listening probably just, yeah, that's me. My tubes always lose air. Most likely, it's one of two things. One, if you have a bike pump that doesn't actually have a PSI gauge and you're just pumping it up until it, like, quote, feels firm with your fingers, in all likelihood, you're not pumping it up enough. Just because it'll feel firm far before it's actually at proper PSI. Two, if you do pump it up to proper PSI and you're still bamboozled by your bike tires going appreciably flat within 2 or 3 weeks, rubber is naturally porous. So car tires are what people are used to, and car tires hold a lot more air and the rubber is a lot thicker, so the air diffuses out of them much slower. But bike tires, if you have like a skinny bike tire and you pump that sucker up, in like 3 weeks, it should be flat-ish, you know, soft. That's just normal. So, yes, that's a general PSA. If you think you need new tubes, pump it up to proper PSI using a bike pump, and or know that they do just go flat over time.
Yeah, Joseph in Turtle Lake, as a matter of fact, has a question about this. So let's go there. Hi, Joseph.
Hello. Hi. The thing that is happening, I've got a particular bike.
Mm-hmm.
That is constantly getting flat tires. And I don't understand why. I mean, we're not riding over curbs, we're not riding over nails, but it's just constantly getting flat tires.
Is it, and when you take the tube out, is there a hole in the tube?
Well, yeah, it leaks. Yeah, somewhere.
So, also a very common question I get. It can be a few things that if you're changing this yourself, you can check. One, when you take that tire off, make sure you run your finger on the inside of the tire just to make sure there's nothing poking through. Two, make sure the sidewall of the tire itself, it might not have something poking through, but the tire itself might have a little hole on the side that when you pump up the tube, and I should clarify, there's a tube, which is a rubber tube, inside of the outer encasement, which is called the tire. So if the outer encasement, the tire, has a little hole in it, and you might not notice it, but the tube could keep pushing out of that hole and popping itself. So either there's something stuck in the tire, there's a hole in the tire itself, or around the wheel, which is the whole big metal part, there's something called a rim strip, which is a little rubber strip that just adheres to the center of the wheel in the inside. And it protects the tube from the spokes. So the spokes that hold the whole wheel together and hold tension, the ends of the spokes protrude, and if that is making contact with the tube as the tube's inflated, it'll pop the tube, like every time.
Oh.
So I would say probably the rim strip, go around and make sure that none of the spokes are exposed at all, and if they are, you can just replace the rim strip, which is like $5, and that should fix the problem.
All right, there you go, Joseph. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ian Astrike, our guest today, founder of Curbside Bicycles in Madison and Chicago. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking bicycles today with Ian Astrike, who is founder of Curbside Bicycles, works out of Madison. and Chicago. And I had to pause there. I'll tell you a story. I had to sneeze, and so I had to cut the microphone so I could sneeze. I don't know if Ian's mic was on or you heard me sneeze or not. But anyway, I'm done sneezing, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. And we have open lines get you on pretty quickly. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Mike, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon, Larry and guest. So I live along a bike path in a park, and I'm constantly watching people ride by, struggling with their knees up in their chest, trying to pedal up a little tiny hill. And so I was wondering if your guests could go over proper bicycle seat height so that people know that they're not pedaling at a toddler level, that they're pedaling, that they can actually pedal their bike without their knees in their chest.
Absolutely. I see that a lot, too. Especially with kids' bikes. I think parents aren't aware that their kids grow and that their bikes should be adjusted accordingly. I'm sure they know they grow, maybe just not the bike part. Yeah, so when you're sitting on your seat, especially for a new rider, I think people feel uncomfortable if their seat isn't low to the ground so they can like firmly touch the ground, which leads to then the seat being too low. So when you're sitting on your seat, you really, when you reach for the ground, you should be on tiptoes, which will result in then when your feet are on the pedals and whatever foot is down, so the pedal is as close to the ground as it'll get, you have maybe like a 10-degree-ish bend in the knee, not a 30-degree bend, which sometimes you'll see, which I think the caller is what he's talking about. So you could ask someone to do that for you. You could just micro-adjust, engage it, but your legs should not be totally locked out. So if you, at the bottom, your leg goes completely straight, then you're really not going to have enough power. Like, you won't be able to use the back of your leg, your hamstring and your calf, to actually continue that pedal stroke because you lose all power by locking your leg out. So not totally straight, but maybe like a 10-degree bend. There's also bike shops you'll usually fit you for bikes.
Yeah, I had fitted. I've been fitted a couple of times with different bikes, and it's nice to have somebody there that knows what they're doing to help you out. Mike, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Pat emailed to say they are still riding a 1988 Giant Sedona paid for with paper route money. Besides tires, everything is pretty much original or working great. Pat is curious, what would make the bike more comfortable for a now middle-aged rider?
Totally. So that kind of ties in. One, make sure that your seat is at a decent height. Two, speaking of seats, a lot of times people say, oh, the seat is too hard or too whatever. I'm going to get a big plush gel seat cover. That actually, on a long term, will make it less comfortable because that gel seat cover will slide around on you. And so then your like butt pressure isn't where it should be on the seat and you're sliding all over the place. So get a good quality seat that's a medium firmness, not a super squishy gel cover. If you are aging with your bike, chances are you bought a bike that might be tipped forward a little bit too much now for your back to enjoy. So they actually make a wide variety for any type of bike of headset adapters or replacements. So what I mean by that is that rather than whatever handlebar height you started with, you can get ones that incline up, that are adjustable, that the whole handlebar stack height is just higher, so you don't have to reach down as far, or that just changes the dynamics of your bike and how you're having to lean forward and how your back feels without replacing your beloved paper route money bike.
I had that, actually had that done on one of my bikes. It made it. And the front, sometimes, I mean, depending on how tall Pat was when he bought the bike and how tall he is now, I mean, and weight and everything else, there may be, the frame may be too, do you see that where the frame's too small for the rider?
Sometimes, especially if they bought a frame that was just within their size and then they shrunk. Then, yeah, it would be a little bit too small. You can also, just talking about comfort, if you're riding a road bike with super skinny race tires, maybe you like bought it and people said, these are the fast tires. You know, they're the 23-millimeter
ones.
And
the lightest.
The lightest, right. The fastest. Unless you're actually racing. I would, because I also have a road bike, used to have very skinny tires. I went from the 23-millimeter tires up to now 28 millimeters. And that thickness really does not increase weight that much. It really does not increase rolling resistance, meaning like how much it's going to slow you down, but it absolutely increases comfort.
Yes.
Yes. Larry and I were in the commercial talking about this. It helps so much with bumps. It just makes you feel more stable on the road. Yeah. Highly recommend if you have really skinny tires, just bump them up a bit.
That's what I did, and it made a world of difference. This year you started doing bike tune-ups, and you mentioned this, for triathlons. You know, go to those events and stuff. Mm-hmm. How stressful is it making sure competitors' bikes are ready for their races?
Luckily, I'll tell a story in a second. So the bikes, the nice thing is on these really high-end bikes, all of the components on them are very high-end. And thus, when you make an adjustment to them, the adjustment actually takes, like, as it should. Everything is working as it should. And if it's not, you can always replace the parts. Versus, say, like, a Walmart bike are kind of just a bunch of hunks of metal that are slapped on the bike and hopefully work well. And if they don't, hopefully the adjustment that you make will take. So the adjustments on these high-end race bikes are actually generally easier. That being said, they are complicated sometimes. And there was one race I was at a month ago that I had to, like, take a guy's shifter apart. And when I did that, this little metal disc fell out. And I was like, oh, no. And so I looked up the parts, like the exploded parts diagram, where you saw every part in order exactly how it's supposed to go. And I put that sucker back together, and I got it working perfectly. But in my head, I was freaking out. I was like, if I have to come to this guy and tell him, hey, so for your race tomorrow, you have no gears. Luckily, that didn't happen. So thus far, all is well.
So you've never been, have you been blamed for a poor performance ever? For somebody who's racing?
No, I run away by the race day, so they can't find me. Thankfully, I have not. It's all gone well, and actually, generally, then I tune up the bikes the day before, so I actually have no choice but to get those bikes finished that day, because the race is the very next day. And then the race day, I usually drive the course and help with flats and stuff. So, in fact, I generally get a great amount of gratitude that I'm able to change someone's tire in the middle of their race so that they can keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I was thinking about some events that I've been on, the 500 miler, where we had.
Oh, yeah.
We had a SAG vehicle.
Yep, you would have to, totally.
It was nice to have that, for sure. What do you think about, here's another question from an emailer. What do you think about fat bikes? Bikes with tires 3.5 to 5 inches wide, they're fun to ride in snow and sand, but are they a good option for mountain biking trails?
Yeah, good question. I think fat tire biking is gaining in popularity, especially here with snow and sand. I mean, we have snow. So for those, super good. For mountain bikes, you could take it. Most of the mountain bike trails and stuff are made for, you know, regular mountain bike tires, which are going to be like 2 to 2.5 inches wide. That's not to say you couldn't use them, but those fat tire bikes are also generally going to be heavier, unless they're super high end. So the problem with the heavier bike is if you're going mountain biking and you need to quickly accelerate up a hill or a ramp or whatever, you might not actually be able to get, depending on your, you know, biking and leg ability, you might not able to be easy to get that acceleration versus a regular mountain bike. A regular mountain bike also, compared to a fat tire bike, will typically have much more suspension. So front fork, rear suspension built in, a dropper seat post. So for the casual mountain bike rider, you don't need to buy a second bike if you already have a fat tire bike. But if you get very into mountain biking, having a dedicated mountain bike is advantageous.
The bike, it was fun watching the biking event at the Olympics.
Yeah.
I don't know if had a chance to see any of it.
Well, any Olympic thing, it just blows your mind. How do people do that?
Oh, my goodness. We were talking about events. What are some biking events coming up in Wisconsin that you recommend for people?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually this upcoming Saturday, I'm helping out with a ride that's just west of Madison in Spring Green area-ish. Mm-hmm. It's called Dairyland Dare. There is four options. There's a 50K, 100K, 150K, and a 200K. So a wide range of rides. Yeah, all in a day. Pretty big rides. But the 50K is doable for most people who want to dip their toes. So that's this Saturday. I'm sure you can still register. It's very pretty. It's, you know, through the Wisconsin countryside. For if people have been thinking about doing a triathlon, but just want to dip their toes in, kind of to like what's called a sprint triathlon, on August 25th, which is a Sunday, there's the Sugar River Triathlon, which is in southern Wisconsin. And so that's a sprint, meaning it's a shorter swim, it's a shorter bike. I want to say like 16 miles, maybe. Don't quote me on that. And then it's like a 5K. So even if running and swimming isn't your thing, you could still do, you know, the short triathlon. And then in September, there's two really cool bike races that I know about. And these are going to be a little bit more southern Wisconsin based, just because that's where my head is. There's a one called Bike the Barns on September 15th, which is a Sunday. Very cool because it goes not only through the Wisconsin countryside, but your rest stops, which many of these rides have rest stops where you can refuel and drink and go to the bathroom. The rest stops are actually at family farms, and they make you like food from their farm. It's really cool. I sat at a rest stop last year, and I was just like, they had a guy playing music. It was super relaxed. I actually fell asleep. And then the weekend after that, also on Sunday, there's one called the Badger Challenge. And that is a wide variety of ride distances, all the way from 3 miles up to 100 miles. I think there's also a run associated with the Badger Challenge. So that's just four, Dairyland Dare, Sugar River Triathlon, Bike the Barns, Badger Challenge. Mostly that's southern Wisconsin, but I'm sure there's others in the state.
Is there a place you can go online and look? I mean, is there a bike association or something that lists all these?
Yes. I'm blanking on the website, but if you just Google Wisconsin bike races, upcoming Wisconsin bike races, I'm pretty sure it's the first link. I can't think of the name, but it lists all the different races in the area, and those four that I said would be on there.
Yeah, and Dairyland Dare, you mentioned in Dodgeville, but it's actually... I'm sorry, you mentioned Spring Green, but it's actually Dodgeville. That is
perfect. Thank you. I know I said Spring Green because I think one. Yeah, whatever. Dodgeville. You're correct, Larry.
There you go. You can join in too. Question about your bike or an event or want to promote one, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I think the Wisconsin Bike Federation also lists events on its website as
that,
well.
Yes, that was what I was thinking of. You got it.
Bikefed.org. More and more people, you mentioned e-bikes earlier. A lot of people are buying and riding them. How challenging is it to fix e-bikes? Is it much different?
The mechanical components on the bike, generally the same. They're going to have shifters. They're going to have brakes. The biggest thing about e-bikes, so for me personally, if there's an electric motor on an e-bike, to a bike mechanic, that's just a black box. You know, we don't open up this electrically like wired motor just because that's not a bike maintenance thing. So know that if you get an e-bike, you're going to be pretty hard-pressed if your motor goes bad beyond reaching out to the actual company you bought it from to get that maintained and repaired. That goes into my next thing about e-bikes of I really, really would recommend people buy from a reputable company and not just buy, since e-bikes have gained in popularity, you can go on Amazon now and just type in e-bike. You can find one for $600 and you think, wow, this is a deal, right? I thought they were supposed to be expensive. They should be more than $600. So I really discourage people from going on Amazon, buying from a random brand, and buying a cheaper e-bike, which I would characterize as anything under $1,000, which for many people isn't cheap. But an e-bike under $1,000 is just going to be made with really the lowest quality components. And if you think about it, you don't want a bike that is quite literally accelerating by itself and also very heavy and carrying you to have really bad brakes on it, which they often do. And also, shipped from Amazon, they're going to be really poorly adjusted. So, can I talk about specific brands?
Yeah, sure.
So, at an entry level, you also have to know that e-bikes that are cheaper are generally going to be heavier. So, you have to think about what are you going to do with this e-bike? If you plan on trying to put it on the rack of your car and drive it around and not just ride it from your house, then you need to get an e-bike you can lift. Otherwise, it's not going in your car. Also, you need to have a bike rack or a car that, like, the bike rack can handle whatever weight the e-bike is. So if weight is no concern, if the e-bike is going from your garage out into the streets and then back into your garage, and it's fine. One brand that's been around probably the longest is Rad Power Bikes. They tend to have decent mid-range components. They're decently priced at low thousands, depending on their model. They have great customer service. I've worked with their customer service department on warranty requests and stuff. They reach out. They're prompt and diligent. But they're heavy as all heck. So you're not going to be able to lift them up generally. Aventon, A-V-E-N-T-O-N, is another brand that would be in the same kind of realm. They've been around. They're not really at risk of going out of business. So you're probably going to be able to get your battery 5 years down the line if it breaks. And then if you actually want a bike that you have a chance of lifting that is made of higher quality components that's going to last you a while, then I would really recommend you buy a bike from like Trek or Specialized or an actual like name brand, big bike brand, because they make really solid bikes. And then the last distinction I'll make is those first two companies I listed, Rad Power Bikes and Aventon, typically are going to have wheel drive bikes. So the electric hub that provides the drive power is going to be on the hub of the wheel. Those are of poorer quality and also less safe and have less longevity than hub drive bikes, which is where the actual motor is between your pedals. So it's like the same place that your feet are generating power, the motor is generating power. And you can find those on a little bit higher end, Trek Specialized, which are going to run you between $2,000 and $3,000. But if you can foot the bill, they're really worth it.
Yeah, really, really worth it. Jim in Mauston emailed to ask if you are considering setting up at Ragbri in Iowa. It's the Des Moines Register-sponsored 6 to 7 day tour across Iowa. I think that's probably the biggest, certainly one of the biggest.
Totally, yeah. This year, no, just because I haven't, connected in with them and such. But this was the first year that I've really started doing a lot of races. So every year I think, okay, how can I expand in this area, in this area? So Ragbri is absolutely in my head. It would kind of be, I just had a baby boy too. So it's kind of, can I get away for a week to go do bike stuff? And also looking at the dates for 2025, which is July 19th to the 26th, I typically have a summer camp I go to. Now I'm just talking to myself personally, but there's a lot of awesome bike races. Ragbri is a great one.
Carmen in Potter, we'll go to you now. Hi, Carmen.
Hi there. I'm calling in response to the gentleman who was he's always getting flat tires. I put Kevlar tires. I have a 10-speed narrow tires, and I put Kevlar tires on it, the same material that they use in bulletproof vests and bulletproof helmets.
Bulletproof
tires.
They're
more expensive, but talk about peace of mind. It's wonderful.
How's the ride with those?
Fine.
Fine, yeah. Well, Carmen, thanks for calling. Kevlar tires.
That's a great point. I brought up all the things you can look for to figure out why you're getting a flat, but not how to perhaps bulletproof in the future. And yes, bulletproof Kevlar tires. They're not actually bulletproof. I wouldn't try to protect yourself with the tires. A brand that I also know of, Continental Gator Skins. I see all the time. Really good tires. A little bit more expensive, but Continental Gator Skins are going to have great puncture protection. Generally, the more expensive the tire you buy, the better puncture protection it's going to have. I also spoke about rim strips previously.
Yeah.
There's two types. One is just a rubber strip. Those are the more common. They always come stock on bikes. They also have nylon strips that you can buy. Those almost never break. So if you're having tons of problems with your tire, get a nylon rim strip, get a tire with good puncture protection, perhaps Kevlar, and yeah, you should be bulletproofed.
Are they more expensive, the Kevlar?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, but they're going to be more.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we're talking, if you buy the lowest end tire, it might cost you $20. Highest end, we're not going to talk highest end tire, but a tire with really good puncture protection, potentially Kevlar, might run you like $50, $60. But it'll last you a long time. So
yeah,
it's,
and if you're 40 miles from them, any from nowhere.
Oh, worth it. Yeah. Or get really comfortable changing your own tires. Yeah.
A listener emailed to say they were at a bike race a couple of years ago and noticed a lack of cable on many bikes. They said they asked someone with one of those bikes how it shifted and was told it was done with an 8-volt battery. How does that work, and does it eliminate the need for tune-ups?
That's funny that they said 8-volt battery. Now it's rechargeable batteries. Yes, so very high-end bikes have electronic shifting on them, so they don't have cables, but rather the shifters communicate, the front shifters that your hands touch communicate with the rear shifters via Bluetooth, and then it just causes the shift to happen by the exact amount the shift needs to happen. So does it eliminate the need for tune-ups? That is one of the pros of electronic shifting, is that there's no cable, so the cable won't stretch. So you'll be able to hopefully go much longer in between tune-ups without the shifting going wonky. However, it can still get out of whack. I mean, it's a computer.
Yeah,
so I do, on these high-end race bikes, I do kind of go into the computer, put it into like adjustment mode and dial it in. But that should, you should be able to go a longer amount of time before that happens compared to a cable. However, the chain is still going to stretch. The cassette is still going to wear. The tires are still going to wear. So even if you have the fanciest, crazy, like, alien shifting modules on your bike, the components could still be wearing, and you could still have poor shifting due to a stretched chain, which is the most common thing I see. So, yeah, it's cool. For me, I think it was a little bit of a reinventing the wheel kind of thing. Yeah. It saves a little bit of weight. It might make it a little bit more slick, but a cable has worked just fine for most. A cable is still working beautifully for many people. So if you think to yourself, oh man, I should get the electronic shifting, maybe ask yourself, are you an elite rider that rides crazy, crazy races across the country? And if not, a cable is probably fine.
Oh man. Ian Aestreich, our guest, founder of Curbside Bicycles in Madison and Chicago. Give a call with your questions. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Talking bicycles and biking today with Ian Aestreich of Curbside Bicycles in Madison and Chicago. Call in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Mike emailed to ask about tubeless tires for mountain bikes. Can they eliminate flats on trails? Tubeless tires.
Yeah, great question. The whole thing, the reason they're touted is to help eliminate flats. So they absolutely can eliminate flats. I'll do pros and cons of tubeless tires. Pros: there is tubeless tire sealant in it. So if you get a hole in your tire up to, I think, a quarter inch, different brands say different things. The tubeless tire sealant basically goes in, it reacts with the air, it creates a seal, and it should seal up your tire so you don't have to replace the tube and have a complete flat. That is the main reason why you'd get tubeless tires. They're also lighter, typically, because there's no inside tube. But the con is you do have to install it or have someone install it, which is trickier than a tubed tire. You do have to add sealant at regular intervals, which is extra maintenance that you don't have to, like, change your tube out every year, for instance, just because. As long as the tube stays fine, it's fine. But you do have to add sealant at regular intervals. Some sealant brands say you never need to add new sealant. I don't think I believe that. In Wisconsin, if you live in an area that you just find you're getting flats all the time for some reason, yeah, great. Tubeless tires. Another consideration, though, is that not all wheels are tubeless tire compatible. So you can't necessarily just go from your current wheel that has a tubed tire and throw on tubeless. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. Usually it says on the side of the wheel. Also, not all tires are tubeless tires. So usually to switch from tube tires to tubeless tires, there is an upfront cost, and then there is an ongoing maintenance. I do actually do maintenance in the winter down in Arizona, just because there's not very many bike riders in need of maintenance here in Wisconsin in February. So I'm down in Arizona doing maintenance there. And there, absolutely, you want tubeless tires because there's cactus thorns. And people get flats crazy all the time. So tubeless tires are almost essential there. Whereas here in Wisconsin, if you haven't noticed yourself getting flats a lot, I would say a tube tire is totally fine, especially if you know how to change it. Yeah.
Bethany in Belleville will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, I'm calling to see kind of what tips and advice you have for getting kids into biking, especially little ones. You know, there's a balance bike, the standard, you know, bikes with training wheels. Just any tips you might have?
Balance bike, absolutely. Because, so to elaborate on the difference, bike with training wheels is a regular old bike, but it has the training wheels that everyone is used to. It sits on the back. All that really teaches the kid, it teaches them, like, what is a bike? How do I move forward? Okay, I move forward by pedaling. And maybe starts to teach them balance. But then there's always that time of, like, you take the wheels off, and they go, whoa, and they're tipping all over the place. A balance bike, even though it doesn't have pedals, pedaling a bike isn't the hard part to teach a kid. The hard part to teach is their core, like, balance. So on a balance bike, a kid doesn't have pedals. They just kick their feet on the ground. And over time, they learn to just go kick, 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 and then kind of lift their feet and coast. And then kick, kick, kick as they lose their balance and then coast. And those coasts become longer and longer. And then you throw them on a regular bike and they're already used to balancing and they can take right off. So I think balance bikes are not only cheaper because they don't have gears and everything, but I think they're a superior way to teach kids to ride a bike. That's what I have to teach my kid.
A balanced bike. Bethany, there you go. Thanks very much for, and I think, you know, one other thing, which is, I think, true in working with a kid, teaching a kid to canoe or to bike or anything else, a shorter time period than you think is probably a good idea.
Not, yeah. Oh, totally.
We're going to go out for 2 hours and do this.
In fact, you could not. I don't think you could 2-hour balance bike around. It would be exhausting. You wouldn't get very far. Yeah, I agree.
Cindy in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Yes. My question for him, and maybe he can shed some light on it for other listeners, is the WARS series, the Wisconsin Off-Road Series for mountain biking. Years ago, I'm talking decades, my husband and I actually were involved in that. He was what they call a wrench for the Hayes Brake team. And it's competitive racing, and it has different levels of skill, and it's really a great time. It's really a lot of fun. So if he could touch on that, that would be wonderful.
The WARS, W-O-R-S, the WARS series of mountain bike races.
So I'm not like intimately connected in with that, but I will say that the WARS series of mountain bike races, as well as many different schools and high schools in the area, especially here in Madison and the surrounding cities, have a lot of different mountain bike clubs. Whether you do what your caller mentioned or a mountain bike club at your school, I think it's a super cool and safe way to get kids into mountain biking, which is very different than just biking on a road, because there's a little bit more risk involved depending on the course. But there's also kind of more thrill. There's more technicality. You're out in nature, and it's really fun to do destination trips to do mountain biking because you get to see different areas. So, it's a great program. There's a lot of infrastructure in Wisconsin, despite us being rather flat. So you may not think of us as like a mountain biking hub. If your kid is interested, see if there's a local ride or a community group, maybe at their school.
Cindy, thank you. Beth in Madison, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hey. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. I have a question about and a comment, if I have time. Somebody was junking a Mongoose bike. I have no idea how many speeds it is. It's a medium-sized bike. It is not one of those wonderful lightweight bikes, but it's not heavy either. I do have a little trouble lifting it myself. But it's a medium-sized bike. It could be an adult use or middle school to high school use. Is it worth taking in to get a right handle repaired? It looks as if the right handle needs a little attention.
Handle being the brake or the shifter?
Shifter, I think.
I think the shifter, yeah. Okay. It's the black handle on the right side. It is not the yoke. It's the right handle.
Okay.
And it was out at a curb. I saw it and I thought, yeah, good idea. Well, I'm not sure if it's a good idea, so I haven't taken it in yet. Is Mongoose a brand worth? I thought it was supposed to be a pretty good bike, but I don't remember where I heard that. What do you think?
I'm actually really glad you brought this up because it'll apply to not only Mongoose, but different brands. So Mongoose, I'm going to say three in particular, Mongoose, Raleigh, and Schwinn. Like Schwinn especially used to be a very good brand, dude. Literally Schwinn quality. And it's on all the old like Latour bikes. And that was the bike. Unfortunately, I don't know how old this Mongoose bike is, but I'm going to have to assume it's a little bit newer if it was on the curb and abandoned. Those three brands, as well as I'm trying to think, Roadmaster, Hyper, any Walmart or Target brand are not good bikes. And but what I mean by that is the components on them are just very cheap, perhaps the reason that the shifter is broken. And so that even if you go into a shop and get that part replaced, the rest of the components on the bikes are going to be on the lower quality side, so that they won't shift quite right. They won't brake quite right. They might squeal. They'll break sooner. They'll wear out sooner. Also, the bikes are typically heavier. Yes. So if you get a hand-me-down of one of these bikes for your kids, absolutely. Right. Like they're going to wear through the bike in a year or two anyways. So you kind of want them to beat this bike up. But if you're looking at sticking money into a bike like a Mongoose that you found on the curb, I would advise against it, because most likely the bike isn't going to be worth it and you'll just run into more problems down the line.
There you go, Beth. Thank you very much for calling. Amy in Milwaukee wonders, how many miles can you get on an e-bike battery charge? And how much does it cost to replace the battery?
So replacing the battery, I can't speak specifically to that, but what I will say is when you buy an e-bike, like I said before, make sure it's from a reputable brand, not a random Amazon brand, so you actually can buy a new battery. Because if the company is no longer in business, you're not getting a new battery, and then you're just stuck with a really heavy bike. So how many miles can you get? Completely depends on the bike and also the model of the bike. And the so usually, just like when you buy a hybrid car, or rather an electric car, and it says, oh, there's the medium range and the long range, bikes typically have the same thing. So when you go on an e-bike website and you're looking at different models, it'll actually list how far they expect you to be able to go. It will depend, though, because there's different levels. So on pedal assist bikes, which is what I would recommend, you don't really want a throttle e-bike, because then that's just a moped, right? An electric moped. So on pedal assist bikes, if you have it to assist level one, then it's really not helping you that much, and your battery will last longer. So if you're just cranking out a throttle on an e-bike and basically using it as a moped, you're not going to get super far.
There you go. Anne emailed. She has a 1976 Schwinn, a Huffy, a Rockhopper, and now a 20-year-old Diamondback. Loves to go on longer bike rides with spouse, but will need a new bike to do that, and wants some help to not feel guilty at age 54 about thinking about cheating and buying an e-bike.
All right, so Anne wants me to help her not feel guilty.
She doesn't want to feel guilty. Great. About having to buy one.
Sweet. So all those bikes, Anne, you listed like a 1976 Schwinn and a 1982 Huffy. Huffy's another name that unfortunately now is not good. But in 1982, 1976, they were good, but heavy. So no, totally. I will say, Anne, if you're going to buy what I said earlier, like a rad power bike, how heavy it is will quite literally necessitate you to use the e-bike power, because you won't be able to bike that sucker and keep up without the e-bike power. So you could do one of two things. You could get just a lighter hybrid or borrow one from your friend and see if that fixes the issue, if you're really feeling guilty about getting an e-bike. But you could absolutely just get a higher quality e-bike and just put it at pedal assist one, like I said. And that way you're not powering along. You're still getting great exercise. It's only helping you a little bit, but it's helping you just enough to be able to keep up so you can go on longer rides.
On that happy note, Ian, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was really a lot of fun, and we'll do it again. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Ian Astreich, our guest, founder of Curbside Bicycles in Madison and Chicago. His website's got a really nice website. Take a look at it, and I know you're going to enjoy your biking and enjoy seeing what he's got on his site. Thanks for joining us today. You know, and thanks a lot to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.